1,500 years. Somewhere, we don't know where. But tonight, Linda was talking about another collapsed year, another important area of time, the year 1500 BC. So, before we start this, just a little reminder, this is the final A4 lecture for 1981. And so once again, we mentioned the contributions that we would all like to have in this Christmas spirit. Okay.
Okay. There are going to be several rationalizations for the quality of the lecture beforehand so that you know why it's going to sound the way it does. First of all, I want to explain the title, which is the year 1500. It's even more, I've taken even more poetic license than this one than the last one, because I'm not going to talk about the year 1500. In fact, I'm going to talk about pretty much the first two-thirds of the whole second millennium in 45 minutes. You'll get a big picture. The reason that I can't talk about 1500 is because what I'm interested in the second millennium, and what I hope you'll be interested in after the lecture, are the ethnic movements. And they all really happen both simultaneously, overlapping at different times, but it's all part of one process, but it goes on for 700 or 800 years. And I want to talk about all of those things. Okay, so that's one thing. I'm not going to really talk about 1500. I'm going to talk about from, say, 1800 BC to 1300 BC. You can figure out how many seconds or how many years that is per second. Go ahead. When I picked the topic, I picked it for a reason, which was that I wrote my dissertation on the second millennium in Iran, and it's an interesting period in the area that I study in Iran, because it's one of upheaval and contraction and possible decline in Iran. And I decided that I needed to know some other things about the second millennium that weren't Iran, and I decided to write the lecture so I could learn about them. Well, here's the first thing that I came to, and it came from Change of History, and I'm going to read you a short quote about this time period. The pages of this history, meaning the whole Cambridge Ancient History, which by this time is three volumes, had little to tell about Assyria or Babylonia since the reigns of Shamshi Adad and of his son in the former, meaning in Assyria, and since the end of Hammurabi's last successor in the latter, meaning Babylonia. The intervening space of nearly three centuries was occupied by the invasions and retarding influences which affected the whole of Western Asia and Egypt as well, and had produced a similar dimness in the view of all that vast area. Meaning, the Cambridge Ancient History has nothing to say about the three centuries between about 1650 to about 1350 BC. And that's always everyone's first source when they want to know about ancient history. They go to the Cambridge Ancient History. Well, they have nothing to say about that period. So that was very discouraging, and I decided that my idea about the second millennium was a very bad one, and I should change my topic. But I haven't done that. What I've done is read a lot of old sources when people were a little bit more interested in this time period than they are now. And our library is out of date, so I may be out of date on my information, but tried to collate all of the information that is up there about the second millennium. And I will try and tell you what I've learned. And probably I won't be able to answer your questions that you'll have at the end, but I will try. Okay. These are some of the peoples we're going to be talking about tonight. They're not parallel designations, and I will explain to you as I go along why they're not parallel. The Amorites, the Habiru or Apiru, the Hyksos, some of which you've probably heard of, the Hurrians, the Kassites, the Hittites, the Mitannians, the Elamites. And again, they're not all the same. Most of them, however, are designations for tribes, usually nomadic tribes, that were running around in the second millennium, took over different areas of territory, and did certain things that people don't like to talk about in the Cambridge Ancient History, because that's why I left it all away. The periods of these tribes and all the various places that they occupied are often called the Dark Ages. I think we'll see that they weren't really dark ages, but from the archaeologist's point of view, from the epigrapher, from the philologist's point of view, we don't have much information. That's partly a product of the archaeologists not looking for those areas because they seem to be the Dark Ages, so we don't want to dig up the cities where the towns are being built. And partly for the lack of textual evidence, which seems to be somewhat illusory, not illusory, more apparent than real. There does seem to be textual evidence for these time periods, and especially by the 14th century, there is quite a bit of textual evidence in some places. But philologists and epigraphers have not really, again, looked, because they're dependent on the archaeologists to find the text, and the archaeologists haven't looked. Okay, and last week I told you that there were two ways to approach the third millennium, or the 3000 BC. Tonight, there are several ways to approach this time period. One is by the tribes themselves, where they went, what they did, what they captured. Another is by the time period, and I made a little timeline here, which anyone can come and look at the end when they get thoroughly confused, because it really does make pretty much sense. You can look at this, whether I'm going to confuse you by my way of doing this. And another way to do it, either time or by tribe, is by the places that we know now, by Egypt, by Mesopotamia, by Anatolia, those places. I've chosen to do it in the third way, even though that's very artificial division, since the tribes conquered places that were not known as Egypt or not known as Mesopotamia, but moved into lots of different areas. And so I'm going to have to repeat myself about what happened in each area. But I think, I'm not sure, but I think that might be the clearest way to explain to you what was going on. Okay. So I'll start with Egypt and work my way up north and see if you can figure out what's going on. Okay. As I told you last week, Egypt was unified in the first dynasty around 3000 BC by this man, Narmer. That means Upper and Lower Egypt, Upper being south, Lower being the north, the Delta area, were united for the first time in about 3000 BC. But by about the 18th century BC, there began to be internal disorders in Egypt, and there was a division between the dynasties, and the country split again, and there was a dynasty reigning in Thebes, which is Upper Egypt, and another dynasty reigning in the Delta area. Everyone knows what the Delta area is, where the Nile is to the Mediterranean. So there were two dynasties founded, not at the same time, but they began to overlap. The 13th, which was founded in Thebes, and the 14th that was founded in the Delta. Clearly the 14th, from our point of view, followed the 13th, but they reigned simultaneously. Okay. That was a symptom of internal disorders where the country was beginning to fall apart. And the 15th, what we call the 15th dynasty, is a foreign dynasty that moved into and took over the throne of the Delta region in about 1720 BC. And these people were called by the Egyptians, actually by the Greeks, and called by us, the Hyksos, these people. Hyksos means rulers from a foreign land. That's all it means.
And
shepherd kings, yeah, yeah. And the Egyptians called these people sort of interlopers, right? They're people from a foreign land who came in and took over at least half of Egypt, that is the Delta region, and down into Middle Egypt. They never actually captured Upper Egypt, which is Thebes, the Valley of the Kings, all that area. But apparently by the 16th or the 17th dynasty in Thebes, the people in Thebes were vassals or paying tribute to the Hyksos. And it wasn't until the 18th dynasty rose in Thebes that they expelled the Hyksos from Egypt. Now, who were the Hyksos? That seems to be still quite a question. They seem to be Semitic, of Semitic origin, by their names. But we don't really know. They've always been thought to come from Palestine,
or from Syria through Palestine into Egypt. But I read a monograph about 2 years ago by an African, a black African nationalist historian who believed that the Hyksos came from black Africa and cited a lot of evidence, none of which was very convincing to prove it. But that is just to show you that not everyone, and he's not a stupid man, and he's not just a nationalist, that not everyone in the world is convinced that the Hyksos were A, Semitic, and B, from Palestine or from Syria. But that's the general sort of consensus of opinion, that they came and they conquered from the Semitic land. Now, there are several problems with that. One is that there are Semitic names in Egypt long before the Hyksos came to power. They appear in the hieroglyphs, hieroglyphic records, as early as the beginning of the second millennium. And we don't know if these people were Hyksos and whether they gradually gained more and more and more power, as you'll see happening in other parts of the Middle East with other tribes, or whether there really was a conquest into Egypt in 1720. But we know that the Hyksos dynasty began in 1720. We just don't know where they came from. We don't know if they had been there for a long time or came suddenly. Another problem with the Hyksos is, if indeed they are Semitic, which they seem to be, are they totally Semitic? But, or are there other elements within the group called Hyksos by the Egyptians? Spicer, for one, who did a monograph in the 30s on the ethnic movements in the second millennium, thinks that they're a mixture of Semitic and Indo-European. Okay, now we have to talk about the Indo-Europeans, who were not really on this list, i.e., stands for Indo-European. Indo-European is a fictive name for a group of people who may be a fictive as well, who seem to have come from the Caucasus in southern Russia in the beginning of the second millennium, and they moved in some undetermined way through Mesopotamia, through North Syria, through Anatolia, and into Europe eventually, and left their mark on all of the Middle East, and eventually moved into southern Iran in the form of the Medes and the Persians, the Achaemenids, you know, you've heard of them, the 5th century, the people who conquered the Greeks, left their mark on Europe. They supposedly brought in horses, horse breeding, horses as draft animals. They brought in the idea of chariots. They brought in a whole new way of warfare. They seem to have been nomadic. And they spoke this fictive language called Indo-European, which is the ancestor of English, and German, and Persian, and Hittite, and Mitanni, and a lot of other languages. Sanskrit, possibly Dravidian, we don't know. The only reason we think that there's an Indo-European language is because all of these languages that I've just mentioned are so similar that they seem to have to come from a similar mother language that no longer exists, and that we call Indo-European because of the relationship with Sanskrit, and European because of the relationship with all of the European languages throughout Japan. Okay, so these Indo-Europeans were a force, and not a very well-defined force, beginning in the second millennium. You see a change in northern Iran in the beginning of the second millennium. And you see elements of the Indo-Europeans in lots of different cultures throughout the second millennium. And it kind of reaches the acme in the Medes and the Persians and the Lydians in Iran, who are the Indo-Europeans par excellence, or the pure Indo-Europeans. At least they claim to be. The Medes claim to be the pure Indo-European. Okay. So the Hyksos may be a group of people who are Semitic with Indo-European elements. They were driven back into Palestine again in about 1580 BC by the first ruler of the 18th dynasty, his name is Ahmose I. Tell me if I'm pronouncing these totally wrong, okay? I don't know how to pronounce Egyptian names. And they again, this is all very chancy sort of evidence. They seem to have been around Palestine until about the 15th century. But because the evidence for the Hyksos is circular, that is, these new things started happening archaeologically in Palestine in the 18th century when these Hyksos were supposed to have come through Palestine. These things, which I will talk about later, these archaeological things, are termed Hyksos. So the persistence of these archaeological things are thought to mean that the Hyksos were still in Palestine until the 15th century. But who knows who the Hyksos were, whether they brought these things to Palestine, and whether these things were maybe a result of a reaction against warlike peoples coming into Palestine. Okay. So, and I'll talk about what people consider Hyksos, quote unquote Hyksos, remains in Palestine a little later, because Palestine is a special sort of problem. Okay, in Babylonia, which, as you probably know, is the ancient or older term for southern Mesopotamia between the Tigris and Euphrates in the south. You've all heard of Hammurabi and his law code, and he unified the country and was a great leader, and his successors were all great leaders. Hammurabi died in 1750, and no one was able to maintain the empire. None of his successors were able to maintain past the 1850s. None of his successors were able to maintain his empire none of them were as strong as he was. But each of them weakened progressively, but by about 1600, his empire was falling apart from internal disorders and external threats. And in 1600, the Hittites, his people, came from the west, from Anatolia, that is Turkey, and actually marched on Babylon, the capital city of Babylonia, and conquered it. But the Hittites were plagued with internal disorders, and they had people on both their flanks fighting them because they marched through territory that was not their own. And they retreated very soon after 1600 and went back to Anatolia. But they left a vacuum in Babylon, and in 1595, these dates are very well, very precise, the Kassites, these people, marched on Babylon and took it. The Kassites reigned in Babylonia and in part of Assyria for 300 years, more than 300 years. Now, the reason I have an A next to Kassites and Hurrians, you'll hear about the Hurrians next, is because they speak a language that people don't really know, no one really knows what it's related to, and it's called an Asianic language, for lack of a better word, that is Asian language, for lack of a better term, because it's not clear what it's related to. It's decipherable, but it's not clear what family it's related to. Okay, so the Kassites seem to have come in from the northeast. They're another nomadic tribe, just like the Hittites, like the Amorites before them, but they are a different language group. We should talk about ethnic affinities a little bit. Races are a problem that I don't want to get into. Maybe Scott talked about that when he talked about bones, I don't know. We're all one species and we're all one subspecies. Races seem to be environmentally and culturally determined, and we won't talk about that. Ethnic groups, however, are defined by their culture, and part of their culture is language. For the archaeologist to define an ethnic group in the past, what we have is their pots, their artifacts. And for us, the best way to define ethnic group is by language. Because if people are mutually unintelligible, if they can't understand each other, it's pretty clear that they're separate groups, and we can call them separate ethnic groups. So all of these people spoke mutually unintelligible. Well, we don't know. They spoke a West Semitic language, the Habiru again. But all of these people spoke mutually in unintelligible languages, and so therefore were probably different ethnic groups. Okay. So the Kassites took the throne of Babylonia in 1595, and they ruled until 1162, when they were conquered by a new Assyrian power coming up. And The Kassite period in Iran and in Mesopotamia in Babylon was very interesting. It's always that those three centuries have been considered the dark ages of Babylon, mostly for the lack of textual evidence. And because the Kassites were considered barbarians, they came in and conquered this wonderful civilized country and they turned it into a morass of uncivilized, uneducated, unintelligent, unlearned peoples. And until 2 years ago, I'd say, we had nothing to disprove that. They built things, but no archaeologists dug up Kassite remains, very many. And their art was considered to be barbaric and decadent and so on. But we started getting texts, actually not written in the Kassite language, written in other languages, about 2 years ago from an area in lowland Iran talking about the Kassite. And it's fairly clear for Iran and for Babylon that the Kassites were an incredibly strong ruling dynasty. All of these waves of nomads, barbarians, and people were running around all around them, and they maintained peace in Babylon and in lowland Iran for 300 years, hardly with blinking an eye that lashed. We don't know why, we don't know how. They didn't write very much about themselves. And other people didn't seem to write about them too much, but they seemed to be very strong and very together about keeping Babylonian peace. We also know that they had good relations with Egypt, and that Egypt, the new pharaohs that expelled the Hyksos, married off their daughters to Kassite kings. So clearly there was some ruling power in Babylon that knew what it was doing and was doing a good job of it. For Iran, though, the Kassite dynasty was rather a disaster. Because although the Kassites maintained peace in the lowlands of Iran and Babylon, they were unable to maintain the control over the trade routes that I told you about last week, that were so important for Iran's lifeblood. And the trade routes collapsed, and the Elamites, who had been living in Iran since the third millennium, were still there, but they totally lost all their prosperity. They seemed to have lost their prosperity, lost everything they had, sort of turned in on themselves. They had no imported goods for all the time between about 1600 and 1200 BC. No imported goods, no written, they seem to have forgotten or didn't need to write. Nothing of very exciting stature. Their cities turned in on themselves, became small towns again, villages rose up, they started using digging sticks and raising their own food. So for Iran, the Kassite invasion or whatever it was a disaster. For Babylon, it seemed not to have been a disaster. Okay, for Assyria, in northern Mesopotamia, we also had a very strong ruling force until about the 18th century BC. And then we get another group called the Hurrians. The Hurrians coming in. They also spoke an Asianic language. We don't know what it's related to again. And by the 15th century, the Hurrians owned all of Upper Mesopotamia and most of northern Syria as well. They were another nomadic tribe that rose to power in Upper Mesopotamia. No one knows how. Their names gradually became more and more common in the Assyrian records. They seem to have been the scribes in North Syria, so they were getting power, they became the intelligentsia. We don't know how. But by the 15th century, they were another power to be reckoned with in the Middle East. In northern Syria, which again, as I told you in the third millennium, Palestine and southern Syria seem to be a group of an area of their own. Northern Syria was separate. Okay. The Amorites, who were a Semitic nomadic tribe coming out of Syria, coming out of the Syrian desert. Probably Hammurabi was an Amorite originally. Probably Shamshi Adad of Assyria was also an Amorite. But the Amorites controlled northern Syria for a long time. But as early as 1800 BC, again, you see the Hurrian names appearing in the Amorite records. In the same time period, about 1800 BC, about a third of the names are Hurrian. Two-thirds of the names are Amorites. By the 15th century, it's reversed. Two-thirds of the names are Hurrian, a third of the names are Amorites. Again, we don't know why, we don't know how, we don't know how they came to power, but again, another tribe, unrelated to all the rest, rose in power in Syria, in northern Syria, and in northern Mesopotamia, and controlled all of that area from the 15th century on. They also seem to have come from the northeast. The only place that the Amorites retained power was in the city-state of Mari, which was on a trade route across Syria and across Mesopotamia. And the Amorites retained power there, and you might have heard of the Mari records, which were written in the 15th century BC. The Amorites stayed there and stayed in power for quite a long time, but the Hurrians took over all in the north. Okay. Now, what about South Syria and Palestine? What's happening in South Syria and Palestine? Again, Palestine and South Syria seem to be in the Middle Bronze Period, which begins about 1850, affected by all of these tribes moving all around them, but not in any direct way. The things that appear in Palestine during this period, which are called Hyksos by a lot of the older writers, Hyksos characteristics, are the glassy. Has anyone ever heard of a glassy? This is a very misleading term in Palestinian archaeology. The Middle Bronze people built walls around their cities and then built ramps running down through the walls, usually like that, sometimes a wall on top of the ramp. And this was supposed to be in reaction to the invention of the battering ram, so that people could not run a hill very easily, so people could not run and batter down the walls. Now, the battering ram was supposed to be a Hyksos invention. Who knows? I don't know. No one seems to know if that's really the truth or not. But anyway, we get for the first time in the Middle Bronze Period in Palestine ramps, glacis, they're called, and moats, or fosse, which is a French word. You probably can't see this. F-O-S-S-E, which is just a moat with no water in it. You know, so that people had a ditch that they couldn't go over and they couldn't scale the wall. Now, both of these are clearly defensive things, whatever the reason and whatever the reaction. And clearly there were people fighting in Palestine. But who they were, whether they were Hyksos, whether they were Hurrians, whether they were Egyptians, at the beginning at least, is not clear. Certainly by the time the Egyptians drove out the Hyksos, They drove them into Palestine, and there was fighting in Palestine and South Syria over caravan routes. And by about 1500 BC, a line was drawn through Homs, is that how you pronounce the name?
Homs.
Homs, in Syria, between the Hittites in the north, who were the Anatolian power, and the Egyptians in the south. So Palestine and Syria were essentially plunder for the either Egypt or the Hittites in the north. And by the late Bronze period, the Egyptians actually had Egyptian governors in Palestine and in southern Syria. The Palestinian and Syrian, southern Syrian kings were allowed to maintain themselves, but they seem to have been pretty titular, and they would pay tribute to the Egyptian governors who lived actually among them. And the Hittites in the north did not send Hittite governors, just let the Syrians rule themselves and pay tribute and taxes to the Hittites. But clearly they were controlled by the Hittites, and the caravans were controlled by the Hittites. Okay, so those are sort of all of what's happening until the 14th century, when there are a lot of records, and when people begin to, things begin to change again. From the 18th to the 14th, let's say, is the time when all of these tribes are gaining power and taking over and settling in. But by the 14th century, the Hittite Empire has expanded out of Anatolia into northern Syria. The Hurrians have consolidated their power in Assyria, that is northern Mesopotamia. The Kassites have consolidated their power in Babylonia. And in Iran, they're doing nothing, essentially. And as I said, the Hittites are in Anatolia, and the Egyptians have consolidated their power in Egypt and in Palestine. But in the late 14th century, the first of the new Assyrian kings rose to power. He drove out the Hurrians. I forgot to tell you about the Mitannians, because it's on the board, and I should tell you. The Mitannians are another group of people that nobody knows anything about, like all of these people. They are Indo-Europeans. Their names appear in the Hurrian annals in Assyria, and they seem to have been a small aristocratic military group that brought their knowledge to the Hurrians. But although people talk about them as being the elite and being the leaders of the Hurrians, they don't seem to be that. They seem to have they're a special sort of separate class of people who are part of the Hurrian dynasty. And by the 15th century, their kingdom is called Mitanni, actually. But Mitanni is really ruled by Hurrians, not by Mitanni. Although the common name among archaeologists is Mitanni. But by the 14th century, the Assyrian king, whose name I won't tell you because it's too hard to pronounce, conquers the Hurrians and begins to reassert Assyrian power. Then the pro-Kassite forces in Babylonia fight with the Assyrians, but the Assyrians win and take and unify Babylonia and Assyria again. At the same time, a new dynasty arises in Iran, which becomes very strong and moves into Babylon as well and captures Babylon against the Assyrians. And so you have these new dynasties asserting themselves, but there are people who are descendants of the people who came before the tribes. And the tribes eventually are conquered by these older people coming back by the end of the 14th century. And even though there are a lot of vestiges of these tribes, the dynasties reassert themselves and peace for a couple hundred years until the Achaemenids come and start conquering all of the Near East. Peace reasserts itself in the Middle East at the expense of all of these wandering tribes. Okay, so that's what's happening. That's not very clear, I think, and maybe you're confused. But I think it's a really confusing period. And compared to the third millennium, which I told you about 2 days ago, which is very homogeneous, very politically stable, controlled, economically viable, this period is very confusing. There are a lot of wars. There are a lot of changes. No one knows very well what's going on. The art seems to change, in most people's opinion, for the worse. And the written records are very scarce until the 14th century, that kind of thing. So it's just a very different thing that's happening in the Near East at that time period. Questions? Yeah, probably can. Me too, yeah. Yeah, it's all very confusing. If you want to look at my little timeline, you're welcome to see what's